Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
And on this week's podcast, we discuss the magic Tory money tree.
Labour's latest trigger ballot rows.
And you ask us, would the Tories have an electoral coalition in moving to the left economically, but staying on the cultural right?
So Anoush, it's been a wild week in the Conservative leadership election, which I feel isn't really true, because it's actually been an incredibly dull week in the Conservative leadership election in terms of the outcome. But it's been quite an interesting week, in terms of various political and positioning choices they have made / semi-made by accident. So Jeremy Hunt has decided that actually no deal is fine and dandy, and that he would make £6 billion available to fishermen and farmers.
And / corporation tax, whether we have a deal or not. And this is all part of it. It's sort of the no deal arms race now, isn't it? Because he obviously got spooked by the Boris Johnson do or die on October the 31st week and decided that he then had to say, OK, yeah, we're going to leave without a deal unless I see a deal being possible by the end of September, is it? Something like that. Something bizarre. And he's had to say, oh, with a heavy heart, I'd let British businesses go bust if it meant that we could get no deal, which really jars with everything that he's been saying so far about how he was an entrepreneur and that he understands business. Clearly not. So that's the predictable part of the campaign. I think the part that's actually more interesting, because we know that they're trying to play to the same very small electorate, 2/3 of whom have no deal Brexit as their most desired outcome of Brexit. So we kind of know why he's doing that, whether or not it's wise. But they've also been bringing out their sort of economic policies as well. I think that's really interesting, because they're both trying to distance themselves from austerity by saying that they're sort of going to turn the taps back on funding. Boris Johnson with £5 billion a year for education, infrastructure spending, borrowing for infrastructure, more police, and then Jeremy Hunt wants to spend more on defence. So this is really funny, because suddenly, magically, there's loads of money to spend. And they're both sort of relying on this fund that Philip Hammond has, the so-called no-deal war chest, which is £25 billion worth of headroom. That's actually just borrowed money earmarked for a no-deal disaster. So how you can say that you want to spend it on education doesn't really make sense. So that's got a lot of Labour MPs amused, because the magic money tree that they're always accused of growing for the purposes of their manifesto is now being mined by the Conservative leadership candidates.
Yeah, I think it's odd, because there are loads and loads of ways that you could, if the next Prime Minister wanted to spend more money. There was an interesting proposal by Onward about ways they could tweak their fiscal rule, where I thought actually part of the cleverness of that is it would allow them to spend a lot more money while maintaining the idea that there is a dividing line between a fiscally responsible Conservative Party and an irresponsible Labour Party, by saying, well, we won't target debt falling as a proportion of GDP, we'll just have it flat or falling, which unlocks quite a lot of extra headroom in terms of the amount you can borrow. The thing I think has been quite surprisingly destructive on Jeremy Hunt's part this week is him saying things like, if we can bail out the bankers, we can bail out farmers and fishermen. It's just like one of those things where it's just like, we almost wanted to tap on the shoulder and go, Jeremy, you understand that video footage, you know, doesn't just vanish magically on the 22nd of July. Like, the Labour Party, I mean, John McDonnell already has, you know, when presented with the world's most simple political, when Jeremy Hunt sent a message saying, hey, John, would you like to have this stick to beat me with? Obviously replied back, yeah, of course, has already gone, oh, right, so you've admitted that the argument for austerity is on shaky ground.
Yeah.
Because I kind of think, we'll talk about this a bit in the next section, that there being money to spend suddenly, I think, is kind of fine for the Conservative Party, because their original promise was, it'll hurt for a half a decade and then it'll be fine. Because it's hurt for longer than half a decade, because they can nominally go, oh, we've achieved our aim of closing the structural deficit, etc., etc. I think politically, actually, it's quite easy to style out the transition from we have to have these cuts to I'm making it rain, you know, you get a car, you get a tax cut. The danger is I think actually the way they're doing it is quite risky to them, because what they need, I think, ideally, is a position where they can defend the idea of austerity but not be doing it anymore. So Jeremy Hunt is now in a position where if he were to become leader of the Conservative Party, which I don't think is likely, but let's give it some headroom, he would be the candidate saying, we've got to listen to business about Jeremy Corbyn, but I'm willing with a heavy heart to let it go to the wall. I'm the one who people who vote for the Brexit Party don't trust, but I've adopted a policy on Brexit that people who are now voting for the Lib Dems strongly oppose. Like, who is he the candidate for?
Yeah.
Like, I just don't understand, like, what he believes his political coalition in either the Tory party or the country is at this point.
Yeah, it's really foolish. You can't really out Boris Johnson, really, on no deal, because he's been the one who's been much bolder about making ridiculous claims about no deal from the start. And Jeremy Hunt has said already that the 31st of October is like a false deadline, and he's been way more cautious up until this week. So it does, not only is it unwise from his coalition of voters perspective, but it's also unwise in terms of authenticity. Like, it just doesn't fly. I don't think that the Tory membership are going to necessarily find it particularly convincing. And then in terms of the idea of moving away from austerity but still defending it, neither of them have done that particularly successfully. Jeremy Hunt quite early on was saying, I regret the amount of social care cuts. I saw beds and beds in hospitals filled with people who couldn't go back into the community because of the lack of social care provision while he was health secretary. I mean, it's quite bizarre to slam your own record like that, and also to undermine the government that you've served in's economic policy in such a sweeping way. I do agree that they need to have a sort of political justification for austerity while they move away from it, and neither of them have done that successfully.
Yeah. So the interesting thing actually about their deal positions, right, is obviously the kind of unspoken sort of possibility that we have to entertain is that there will be an election later on this year, which I go wildly back and forth sometimes within the same minute about whether or not it will actually happen. I think the interesting thing is the way that a bunch of Labour MPs have started to now say, you know, having had three opportunities to vote for it, I really feel I could vote for it on opportunity four. And I don't doubt that they believe themselves to be sincere. But of course, the really significant thing is now that essentially neither of the Conservative candidates is really saying they're going to bring it back.
Yeah, exactly.
They are both saying they will seek changes to the backstop of a nature that are not going to be forthcoming, right? So, of course, that does make it easier if you're a Labour MP to say, actually, I would now vote for it if you feel you may not be asked to do so. I think in an odd way, the worst position for them politically is one in which they go into an election this year having basically said, God, the public realm is in a mess, having done nothing to fix the public realm, and slagged off the idea of austerity.
Yeah. Yeah, makes no sense. So we discussed deselection a bit in the last podcast, and there's been an update on that story in the Labour Party, hasn't there? So, Stephen, why don't you tell us what's happened?
Yeah. Oh, so firstly, I realised from two emails we got that there was clearly some slight confusion about the rules change, and I didn't explain it properly. You now need to get two-thirds of both your party branches and your affiliate branches. You can no longer get through by only having a majority of both, which means you can no longer game the system by adding loads of loyal affiliate branches to get you out of trouble, which is, of course, a really important
okay.
change.
Okay, yeah.
So I was about to say the interesting. I mean, actually, I think the really interesting thing about this story is it's not that interesting. So there is a story that has been picked up by a couple of places and was originally broken on Politics Home that some Labour MPs are circling the wagons over, which is that Ellie Reeves, the Labour MP for Lewisham West and Penge, one of her members has called for her to face a no-confidence motion and for the trigger ballot process to be begun because of her support for a letter saying Chris Williamson should have the whip withdrawn. And this has been publicly condemned by broadly what I guess you would probably call Labour's old right, or it's like former, like, you know, ballsite
Yeah.
Contingency.
Okay.
And almost everyone else has been quite quiet about it. Now, the reason why I think there's a lot in this story is, like, to be honest, it is one letter, right? It's one letter. One letter is not a third of all branches, let alone, because obviously to get rid of an MP, you've got to clear two hurdles. You firstly got to have a third of branches to vote against re-adopting them. And then, of course, you need 50% of the overall membership plus one. Now, because the branches are not weighted by membership, they are pure, you know, like if there are 10 branches in a constituency and most of the members live in four of them, it doesn't matter. They all count the same. So that, of course, can mean that you can have a situation where someone would certainly lose a false election. And there are several MPs who believe they certainly would lose a false election, but who are not going to be triggered because of where the balance of their membership actually lives. The important thing is ultimately, like, this is not an example of something which may actually lead to deselection. That is one of the reasons why so few MPs have decided to assert themselves, because there's essentially a split in the Labour Party about, you know, a fairly minor split, giving splits in the Labour Party, about how to deal with this time of trigger ballots.
Mm.
Some people basically think you need to circle the wagons, and any kind of public story about deselection, you kind of need to go, oh, you know, this is awful, our great movement of ours, we need to be a big happy family. And some people basically think that the way that they will get through this is by being fairly quiet, through trying to, you know, just essentially keep their heads down and to organise locally but quite quietly, and believe that essentially, as long as the salience of PLP versus activists or PLP versus Corbyn is kept low, they will be elected fine. The interesting thing is we just don't really know, A, which one of those will work, but B, whether or not you actually can successfully maintain the don't raise the saliency.
Mm.
Because I think the fact in this story has now been picked up by The Guardian, it's been picked up by a couple of other outlets. Now, yeah, of course, actually, like, you know, most Labour members are nowhere near as politically active or engaged as people who listen to this podcast or, you know. However, what would worry me if I were in the we just need to lower the salience, say some nice things about socialism and it will be fine tendency is this is going to play out over a summer in which there is going to be not very much other than go back to Brussels and renegotiate the backstop. Is, I think, even if, and a lot of MPs think, and a lot of MPs and a lot of organisers on both sides of the factional divide believe that actually this will, in the end, be not much, will actually be much less transformative than people think. They think a fair number of people will get triggered because it's ultimately only a third, but most of those people will very comfortably win re-selection. And a lot of MPs are essentially treating their trigger process as a data gathering exercise for winning that re-selection. Now, that may or may not be true. However, if your approach to that being true as an MP is just decrease the saliency of PLP versus Corbyn, you have this big problem that the media is going to hugely increase the saliency of PLP versus Corbyn because that is a more sexy story.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the sad thing about this story is that, you know, for all of time, you've had people in local parties, for all parties, who will be unhappy with their MP and be, you know, constantly challenging them and writing to their party chair. And I mean, I don't know who the person is who wrote this letter, but I mean, any reporting that I've done over the past, you know, 7 or so years, you know, you'll always find a crank or two in a local party who's happy to write letters like that and make a nuisance of themselves. But now that kind of letter has so much resonance because MPs do feel, lots of them feel sort of even fearful of their local parties, and that suggests that the tone of local politics is so toxic now that even if one letter can cause that reaction, that says enough about the situation that MPs are in to take it seriously, if you see what I mean. Because, you know, someone could have got that letter a few years ago before the sort of Corbyn times and the divided politics that we have now because of the referendum, and it wouldn't have mattered. But now, because everyone feels so precarious, it's something that MPs feel the need to condemn, and that's really sad.
I also think, right, there is this weirdness that no one really knows how Labour's rule change is going to work in practice. But the one thing we do know is that the old rule change rules in practice meant you could not be deselected unless you were actively incompetent, actively had annoyed your local party, and the various local affiliates all decided to gang up on you. Now, I was about to say you can construct an argument and that's fine. I, to be honest, don't really think you can. I think one of the problems that, you know, the kind of time bomb under the Parliamentary Labour Party has always been that the previous trigger ballot system was very hard to defend.
Yeah.
And then because no one had thought seriously about, well, if you had a system when you could defend, what would it be? Which means then essentially you have a change which, when it happened, lots of people thought, oh, this is great for us. Yeah, people wanted to get rid of MPs. Because essentially, if you can't pass this threshold, you're probably going to lose the selection. So it's as painless as this experience can possibly be. I think the fear a lot of people now have is that actually the barrier to triggering might now have gone the other way. It might be too low.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with a very poisonous summer, your bad atmosphere, going into an autumn election, etc., etc. But at the end of it, you've actually failed to change the makeup of the PLP all that much. Because the one of the reasons why MPs are so stressed is, right, is the party that they are getting reselected by is completely different to the party that they were selected by, even if you were selected the first time in 2015.
Yeah.
The flip side is that party, even though membership is down from its peak, is still really quite large. It's really expensive to get selected anyway. This is going to be a really expensive event in the life of people who usually give money to the Labour Party in the run-up to an election. And it might be that actually a lot of that money ends up being wasted because the person is the same as they were at the end of it.
Mm.
But yeah, I think it is partly about our divided politics. But I do also, you know, as I said last week, I do think there is this slight thing that because of the way the rules existed before and because there is no institutional culture in the other parties of the idea that reselecting an MP is a good idea in of itself. Although it's much easier to get rid of your sitting Lib Dem MP, there is no tendency within the Lib Dems that believes that you ought to have a full selection just because. Whereas there are people across the right, the left, and the middle of the Labour Party who believe that a fresh selection is a good in of itself. I do, to be honest, have a fair amount of sympathy for the idea that you should have a sort of fully open process. But understandably, that makes Labour MPs quite nervous. Whereas with the Conservatives, weirdly, it's always personal if you get deselected. It can be ideologically personal, it can be personal because you're rubbish. But there is no, other than a very eccentric few, when you speak to Conservative members, there is not a large group of people who think that there ought to be a full selection just because of it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And the reason why I suppose Labour MPs are in a slightly different situation, although there have been accusations of entryism in the Conservative associations, is that it wouldn't be personal, it would be ideological, which is bad for the party in terms of its broad church and its history and its sort of brand.
Yeah, I also think the weird thing is that if you're a Labour MP who thinks you're going to be deselected because your party has changed ideologically, people don't like being in a situation where they can't control, that where they basically can't control or improve their political situation very easily. If you just have organised things of people from Leave.eu joining your local Conservative Association, there are many more organisational things you can do, or you can do what a number of Conservative MPs have started to do, which is to basically go, well, I've always thought No Deal was brilliant. And you're like, have you? But of course, I mean, it may of course be that the group of MPs who basically think, look, we just keep our heads down, we just say, you know, trigger ballot is what the trigger ballot is, it's always been, and we'll be fine, will be proved right. My instinct is they have a better chance than lots of people think. But I do think, yeah, this does really... the really important thing this shows is that if your plan to manage your trigger ballot process as an MP was, let's have this be as non-dramatic a time in the Labour Party as possible, the bad news for you is that, ironically, people who you are more ideologically close to than the people who you were hoping to win over are probably going to ruin that for you.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Thank you.
now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
And this week's question is, imagine for a moment that the Conservative Party moves to the left on economics, but continues its cultural positioning on Brexit, immigration, crime, I guess. Could that party win an election?
And who's the question from?
The question is from several people on Twitter, actually, but I've managed to once again lose the question. Note taker, note underscore taker on Twitter.
Okay, so it's going to be noted down, whatever
you don't,
say.
You don't even have to have a Twitter account. You can, if you can email, tweet or Facebook us entirely anonymously, and we will still take your question, provided it is not libellous or slanderous, I guess.
Yeah. So I thought about this question when I saw it, and... It sort of reminded me of when UKIP were on the up a few years ago. Remember when they sort of spooked David Cameron into even wanting to call the referendum in the first place? There was a lot of writing about the division between red UKIP and blue UKIP, because there was this contingent in UKIP who were promising more money for the NHS and saying quite left-wing things on the economy, in contrast with how the sort of original party used to set itself up as in favour of privatisation and small state economics. And that kind of divided the party, and obviously UKIP is a mess of factions anyway, but it really didn't work for them in terms of their organisation and their ideological purity. And I think that would be the same for the Conservative Party. Even if the leadership of the Conservative Party wanted to move more leftwards on the economy, how would they ever get any of those policies through Parliament? I just don't think there's enough Conservative MPs who would want the party to move in that direction. So I think in terms of organisation and actual sort of practicality, it wouldn't work for the Conservative Party.
Could the Conservative Party theoretically pick up more votes and retain its existing coalition with a sort of more... slightly more state spending, but by retaining all its, more authoritarian pro-Brexit position? Probably. Although, I think in general, right, the important thing that everyone kind of forgets, whenever someone says, why doesn't the Conservative Party just become a party of Brexit? Why doesn't the Labour Party just become a party of Remain? Is, or indeed vice versa, right, is this idea that you have, like, a Leave vote made up of people who are left behind economically, or you have a Remain vote of people who are doing fine, is just not true, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, like, broadly, Labour Remainers and Labour Leavers have more in common in terms of what they want out of the economy, and indeed their actual economic condition, than they do with Leavers or Remainers of either type. Mm-hmm. So it's quite hard to get a parliamentary majority for either side with an approach of just building out on your Remain or your Leave flank. Because you're basically, it's kind of like the problem the Lib Dems had before when the coalition was still exerting a more powerful electoral tax, right? Because only half of the voters were willing to consider voting for them because of the coalition, but only half of voters voted to Remain, and only half of Remain voters had thought the referendum should be refought. Mm. They were actually going for half of the half of the half of the half. And basically, I'm not convinced that the approach of become a bit more left economically, stick with Brexit and the broader cultural perspective actually adds up to 325 seats. But in many ways, the more important question, I think, is actually your point about could you get the Conservative Party as it... Yeah, and this, again, is missing from Labour's Brexit debate, right? It's very easy to have for people to have loads and loads of arguments about what position Labour should have. However, an equally important argument, if you are sitting in Jeremy Corbyn's office, is what is the position that a Clause 5 meeting, the meeting where it sets the manifesto, or Labour conference is going to agree to? Because broadly, your political strategy has to be based around winning support for that actual policy. Now, of course, sometimes you can take that approach too far. Nick Clegg in 2010 being the example, right? He didn't think that the tuition fee policy was a good idea. He didn't think that their costings for it worked. When he lost the vote at Lib Dem conference to take it out of the manifesto, he then went, well, I guess we'll make it the centrepiece of our election campaign, which was obviously a very foolish thing to do. But yeah, I don't really buy that they could get it through this parliament, even allowing for the fact that hung parliaments love, spending things and not raising taxes.
Yeah. I think they'd struggle. But then in terms of actually appealing, I don't know if they could win an election. Say theoretically they managed to get this stuff through their MPs. Could they theoretically win an election having moved more to the left on economics? I actually think they've got way more room than we think, because even when I've gone reporting in places like Theresa May's seat, Maidenhead, which isn't a Leave voting seat, but it's not sort of heavily Remain either. You know, even Conservative councillors have, well, especially Conservative councillors, have noticed the impact of 9 years of austerity. So I do think that more spending is not necessarily the sort of Labour bogeyman that lots of the Conservative grassroots used to think it is, because they've seen for themselves, you know, they've experienced potholes on the road and they've seen homeless people, and, you know, they probably have people in their family who have struggled to get the care that they need, or they've seen the hospital in crisis, because that's what everyone sees, regardless of your demographic. So I do think that they probably have quite a lot of wiggle room in terms of their voters and their grassroots, but it's just MPs are so tribal and so ideological sometimes that I think that I just can't imagine a majority for them moving to the left on the economy in this parliament.
Yeah, I think particularly because this parliament is particularly finely balanced.
Yeah.
You only need Philip Hammond and two other people who are economically dry, don't like Boris Johnson, don't think they have a future in the Conservative Party anyway, to go, well, no, I'm not voting for it. I think, so the other sort of interesting point in all of this, right, is, so we were also asked by in this question, you know, like, how could Labour respond to that happening? I mean, I think the weird thing is, actually, if you look at Labour's sort of economic and cultural positioning, there has been far less resistance, both to Jeremy Corbyn, but actually throughout the Labour Party's history, right, if you actually look at the content of Labour's 1997 manifesto and messaging, to, like, you know, the problem with austerity is we don't hire enough border guards.
Mm.
Like, you know, like, there has been very little resistance to that. And it seems to me to be a lot easier for Labour to move into that position without large bits of its coalition and large important internal actors within the Labour Party kicking off.
Yeah.
You can find plenty of people, MPs, trade unions, activists, who will roll their eyes at the problem with austerity is, you know, we need to have more border guards. But it's quite rare to find people in the Labour Party who are willing to upset the whole apple cart in order to get rid of the problem with austerity is we don't hire enough border guards. Whereas it's quite easy to find Conservatives who are willing to upset the apple cart if it's not reducing debt as a share of GDP.
Exactly.
The question, though, is, I don't know about you, but it feels that both, you know, when you're out in the country reporting, when people write in about, you know, Corbyn, when you, you know, do a panel show or two, like, one of the more interesting zombie beliefs about Jeremy Corbyn is that he is like some, like, culture warrior, identity-based, like, new, capital N, lefty, when he just palpably isn't. Like, if you actually look at the things he actually believes and actually says, Jeremy Corbyn is not a man who, you know, like, who, you know, like, this idea that Jeremy Corbyn is obsessed with issues of identity is just not true.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll get so many sort of people who don't really understand that saying things about Jeremy Corbyn, you know, like joking about the fact that he's a vegan and, oh, you know, the snowflakes love their magic grandpa or whatever they like to call him. And that, I think, is a complete misreading of Jeremy Corbyn. So I agree with that.
Yeah. But I think the interesting thing about that, right, is for a lot of people on both sides of the kind of Remain Leave, whether you think Remain Leave is actually what the divide is or if just Remain Leave happens to map pretty well onto it. But the interesting thing is a lot of people on either side of that cultural divide perceive Jeremy Corbyn to be one of the Remain guys.
Yeah.
Which I think is why a large chunk of people who now swear blind that they voted Labour to stop Brexit, when the Labour Party was very much not in 2017 saying it would stop Brexit, and Jeremy Corbyn had won not one but two Labour leadership elections on a platform of either saying he was open to the idea of a Leave vote and then saying he wanted to accept the result, is he's coded, as it were,
yes,
as a pro-Remain politician. And I also think that is probably why so many people have invested their hope in Yvette Cooper or other people who are not actually advocating a second referendum. The flip side of that is precisely because then it partly seems to be about how people perceive someone on that wider, like, social liberalism versus not social liberalism divide, is where that gets you is actually where the Labour Party is probably its most electorally effective, is if it could get someone like Andy MacDonald to be leader, who sounds and I think is coded to a lot of people as someone in the, like, the more Leavey end of the shadow cabinet, but actually is someone who goes on and goes, no deal means the end of steel, I think maybe we should have a referendum. You know, like, can you expand your coalition simply by having someone, a different leader who has the same policy offer but is coded differently to a different bit of the electorate? Because I think if the answer to that is yes, the perverse thing is the Conservatives actually, I think, have more options to do that, right? They have more people who are coded as Remain or coded as Leave, but who could go the other way.
Mm.
Of course, the weird thing is that they don't want to. So in many ways, they're in exactly the same position as the Labour Party. It doesn't matter that it's hard to find someone, this theoretical candidate who's like coded as Leave, but could do Remain things for the Labour Party. The Labour membership doesn't want to, so it's kind of a bit redundant. The Conservative Party doesn't want to. And I just feel like that does feel like the biggest problem with the could a party win by doing this is you have to be able to take your party with you.
Yeah, exactly. Although I would say that actually I think Jeremy Corbyn has so far benefited from being someone who's coded as a Remainer, because he is someone that a lot of his membership sort of project whatever they want, whatever they believe onto him, even though he hasn't said half the things that they would have liked him to say. And, you know, that showed in when he was challenged by Owen Smith, it showed in that result, because Owen Smith went into that election saying that he wanted a second referendum before it was cool. And everyone just voted for Jeremy Corbyn again. And you know, that was because they felt that he's someone who represents their values, even if he hasn't specifically said the things about Brexit that they would like him to say. So he's sort of benefited from having this aura of like, I'm left wing and cool and young, and I understand about, not young, but you know, I understand the young people's interests and values, and I spoke at Glastonbury, etc. But actually on paper, lots of that stuff isn't really true.
Well, it is why I think that Jeremy Corbyn was a net, and I emphasise the word net because I feel every time I make this point, someone appears via email to send me a long patronising email going, but what about this group of people who he was repellent to?
Yeah. That's
why I think Jeremy Corbyn was a net electoral asset to the Labour Party in the 2017 election, because he was coded as Remain.
Yeah.
He had an unambiguously Leave position, and he could get away with that position.
Yeah.
I think part of the Labour Party's problem is that that position at the moment does not look to be electorally lucrative.
Mm.
It may be, as I say in my cover story, then Boris Johnson becoming leader fixes that and makes it electorally lucrative again. However, if an electorally lucrative position does not exist, then you suddenly end up in a position where it's basically going, so you can have two bad things happen to your electoral coalition. Would you like option A or would you like option B? And because Labour is divided as to what the right thing is to do, they just sit here having this attritional argument about what the most electorally efficient way to punch themselves in the face are. But I think, yeah, it obviously was a benefit to him that he was coded as Remain. The difficulty now is that he's, I think, still coded as Remain for a lot of Leave voters. But he is not coded as Remain for a lot of Remain voters.
Yeah.
Even though actually, like, their position has become increasingly pro-second referendum, right? He's now saying in the chamber, it's time for a public vote, etc., etc.
Yeah, it's interesting that the people who are hearing that message are the Leave voters rather than the Remain voters that it's aimed at.
Yeah, and I think that the combination of qualities which made him a net asset last time might now make him a net this benefit at the moment, although of course all of this comes with the really important caveat that we don't yet know and won't really know until, you know, the experiment is actually wired into the computer and the election happens, what the effect of the fact that the Conservatives are about to very strongly intensify their own, like, I mean, they really are going full on to the we are coded as the Brexit people brand. Now that could work, it could end up being quite humiliating. And I think the weird thing at the moment is it feels to me that one of the political parties, maybe both, is going to look very stupid after the next election. However, it's not wholly clear to me that they actually do have a better strategy available than the ones they've opted to have.
Mm. I think that about Labour. I mean, every time someone says to me, oh, why, you know, they're sitting on the fence, why didn't they do this, why didn't they do that, on both sides of the argument, I understand the frustration, but I really don't know what I would have done differently. And like every inch towards a second referendum, I've always felt instinctively was really risky. And you can tell from the way that they've kind of been dragged kicking and screaming into that position that they feel that. And, you know, even pollsters, like no one really knows what the most electorally beneficial sort of Brexit position actually is. And it does depend a lot on who he's up against. So if it's going to be Boris Johnson, that could really help because it makes it sort of black and white. But it could also make people really disillusioned, because choosing between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, a lot of people won't like those two options as their only real choice.
It's one of those odd things where I realised, someone said, oh, what would you do? I realised, because I spend so much time going, well, look, you have this group, which one's that? You have this group, which one's that? Then I haven't properly sat down and gone, well, what would I have done in this terrifying hypothetical universe in which I had Seamus Milne's job?
Yeah.
I kind of think, in a way, and it's very easy to say with hindsight, they've got to free themselves from this idea that the whole of the Labour Party is locked into, that their Brexit policy can primarily be seen as an electoral one.
Mm-hmm.
They have to work out what it is they want out of it. The difficulty is that's actually not a helpful answer, because, again, you end up with this situation where if you ask the Labour Party what it wants out of the Brexit process, you get 8 different answers. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Anoush Shekelian. It's recorded by Emily Bootle and produced by Nick Hilton. Apologies for the sound quality last week. Our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.